The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation. Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And because we couldn't be left behind by all of the other podcasts out there, we have decided that we are now going to do an episode on COVID-19.
Yep.
We are going to attempt to keep this focused on the medical examiner's role in this crisis. We'll, of course, do some general information, but then we'll focus mainly on what we are going to be, what we would be dealing with in this crisis.
Yes, exactly.
And we are drinking a mixture of two whiskeys, which I know most people would call
a cocktail.
I was going to say, what's the word? Crime against nature? There's a better word for that.
Travesty?
Something. Yes. Many people would call it a travesty, but one of the whiskeys is this whiskey called Screwball, which is a peanut butter flavored whiskey.
Yeah, it was recommended to me by one of my friends, and it is delicious.
Yes.
Not that I'm biased. I love peanut butter.
By itself, it is really good and very sweet.
But mixed with the Wild Turkey rye, it's a very nice balance.
Yes, and it's very drinkable. By itself, I don't think I would have been able to get through an entire drink of it, but...
Oh.
Quote-unquote cut with wild turkey. Very good. So there was a webinar by the IACME.
The International Association of Coroners and Medical Examiners.
This past week. And they talked about the medical examiner and coroner response to this crisis. And one of the lines that Dr. Sally Aiken said was, a good summary of this crisis is prepare for the worst and hope for the best, but be practical. So I think a lot of what we're going to talk about is that, and I kind of wanted to start it with that in mind. COVID-19, I'm going to kind of blow through some of the basics that we know about this virus. There's a lot that we don't know, but I'm going to kind of blow through some of the things that we do know. So it is a coronavirus, which people have just been calling it the coronavirus, but coronaviruses are actually a pretty large family of RNA viruses. The most common thing that we associate with coronaviruses are the common cold. Many people, I'm sure 99% of you that are listening, have had a coronavirus at some point, but it is not quote-unquote the coronavirus.
Yes.
It causes illnesses in animals and humans, and usually we don't type it. So, like, if you get a cold, they don't do a swab on you and see what kind of coronavirus you have. This is a very unique circumstance. Some of these in the past have been worse. So, if you've heard of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS, those were both also coronaviruses that had worse outcomes, that were more infective or more lethal, much like this one, but to a less extreme. This particular strain that we know as COVID-19 started, in, as far as we know, heavy emphasis on as far as we know, in December 2019 in Wuhan, China. It's postulated that it started at a wet market from, I know various animals have been implicated, pangolins and bats and blah, blah. And I don't think that any... From what I looked at, no study has been able to pin down exactly what animal host it came from.
Yeah.
But it came from some animal host and popped over into us. Symptom-wise, the most common things that people see are fever, fatigue, and a dry cough. If you have any of those, assume you have coronavirus right now. But it can also cause aches, pains, nasal congestion, runny nose, sore throat, diarrhea. Kind of all the normal things you associate with having a cold or a mild flu type of thing. These numbers are going to be very vague because we don't really know numbers pretty well right now. About 80% recover without needing any treatment. About 1 in 6 people become seriously ill, have difficulty breathing, and have to go to the hospital. We know that it's worse in old people. We know it's worse in those with underlying medical conditions like obesity, hypertension, so high blood pressure, cardiac issues, or diabetes. We know that for sure it's spread by droplet, which is particles larger than 5 microns. And we're pretty sure that it can also be spread via airborne. And all that airborne means is a smaller particle, so less than 5 micron particle. And those are the things that the N95 will protect against. And these can be spread whether you're symptomatic or you're not symptomatic. So even if you have it, but you don't have a fever or a cough or anything, you can still spread it to somebody else. You can protect yourself first and foremost by washing your hands and not touching your face. Generally a good idea. Stay clean. Of course, we're taking social distancing precautions, staying away from people in general, not going into work, staying more than 6 feet away. People have started now, CDC is recommending wearing a face mask whenever you're out, which is mainly to protect others rather than to protect yourself. So if you cough or sneeze, it gets caught in the face mask. Or if you talk, the little tiny particles that do come from when you talk get caught in the face mask. And treatment right now, a lot of things that are being done are symptomatic treatment. So if you have trouble breathing, we'll help support your breathing. There aren't any proven studies right now for medication treatment. Things are being started. Hydrochloroquine has been postulated to help, but there are zero randomly controlled studies that have proven this. So we are very early stages in this still. It only just started in December 2019, which was only 5 months ago.
Which is crazy.
It feels like so long.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't want to throw in here about hydroxychloroquine. So one of the side effects is it can cause long QT, which the episode that we just released, we talked about congenital long QT. So this is one of the drugs that people with long QT can't take because it can prolong that interval even more and cause them to have an arrhythmia even faster. So just interesting side note from last week's episode. Or 2 weeks ago's episode.
So in terms of the current number of cases nationally, so in the U.S., there are over 395,000 cases that have been reported. New York continues to be one of the hardest hit states with over 130,000 cases and just a little bit over 5,000 deaths statewide, over half of which are in New York City. And recently, some very stark and alarming disparities have been emerging in places that are reporting COVID-19 data by race. So definitely looks like it's disproportionately affecting minority communities in places that are reporting that data. And then globally, there have been over 1.36 million cases reported with 76,315 deaths reported in 184 countries around the world. And the U.S. continues to lead the world in the total numbers, though Italy, Spain, and Germany are all reporting over 100,000 infections.
Yes. And if you look at the cases per million population, the U.S. is definitely not the highest. Italy and Spain are far and above the U.S., but since the U.S. is such a more populous country, our base numbers are much larger.
Yeah. Some happy news. This Monday of this week, China reported no new deaths from COVID-19 in Hubei for the first time since January. So it seems like a lot of the public health interventions that have been being put in place around the world are starting to take effect. So Jordan mentioned this earlier, but lockdowns and shelter-in-place ordinances continue to be in place in many countries. In the U.S., an estimated 90% of the population are under shelter-in-place/stay-at-home orders. There's been recent evidence to suggest that this is actually helping to curb the number of new cases and deaths, which is what we're here to talk about. So
yes.
A recent study estimated, using mathematical models, that the number of deaths averted due to implementation of these stay-at-home shelter-in-place interventions is estimated to be about 59,000.
Good job, everybody. That's all because of you.
Yep. Another thing that they said in this study was that the estimates imply that we're not anywhere close, at least in Europe, to having herd immunity. Less than 50 to 75% of the population has been infected is what they estimate. And the number of cases that each new case can cause is still greater than one. So if somebody has the disease, they're likely to pass it on to more than one person still.
So herd immunity is when everybody has been, or most people have been exposed.
Or vaccinated.
Or, well, should I count as an exposure? So once you have built up the immunity, you can't get reinfected. So when you do social distancing, you're reducing the number of people that get infected. So that means that there are more people that haven't been infected. So we can't just open things up right away because there's a lot more people that can get sick because they haven't been exposed and haven't gotten better from their sickness.
Yeah. Yeah, so the conclusion of this paper was that while the interventions look like they're helping to slow the number of new cases and deaths, COVID-19 will continue to spread if we stop the interventions as things currently stand.
So why do we care, right? We're talking about, as medical examiners, obviously death rates are going up. We're going to have more cases that might have to be autopsied or things like that, but people are dead. One of the really important things that a lot of people don't think about is when you go to the grocery store, when you get home with your groceries, you're supposed to wipe off your groceries because it can stick around on metals and plastic surfaces and things like that for a very long time. When you die, that virus doesn't just disappear. It stays around in the body. And when a body is stored at 4 degrees Celsius, it actually can keep the virus around for a little bit longer. So you're kind of almost preserving the virus a little bit. And then when you go to do the autopsy, you're not just... And Cole is very awake, so any bashes are her onto the box. So then you go and you do your autopsy. You push on the chest. You're then expelling air through the decedent's mouth and nose, which is then pushing particle into the air. So people don't often think about spread after death. People kind of assume at that point you're stopping it, but in our world, very much so you're not. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the medical examiner system isn't only taking care of the person that has passed away. You go to that scene and you pick up that body. And when you're doing that, you're dealing with the deceased family. And if the deceased had COVID-19, their family probably has it. And they're live people that are talking to you and coughing and sneezing around you. So then they can expose you. So the medical examiner system... This is very important to not only the medical examiners, but to the death investigators, to anybody that's going to be dealing with bodies and families and things like that. Also importantly, a lot of times when somebody has died, you may not know what their symptoms were before they died. If somebody can report that they had a fever and a cough, you can be like, all right, well, we're going to presume that they had COVID, and we're going to take extra precautions to make sure that we don't get exposed. But if somebody was found dead in their house, they might have had symptoms for several days, but they're not reporting that. And you need to decide when you're going to take those precautions. You also might not know their travel history, so you don't really know what could have gone on. One of the things that this conference talked about was how do you coordinate investigating a death scene with the decedent and the decedent's family. They talked about how ideally you would have an N95, which is going to stop most particles from getting into your nose and mouth. We're not counting eyes here because that can also get into your eyes. But so ideally you would have an N95, goggles, and a face shield. They mentioned that any family that's symptomatic should be separated into a different room. Investigators, the ones that are going in to talk to family or police or anything, should really gather all their information outside and not get themselves in a small room. If you're in a big open area, aerosolized things can spread out over a longer area. Versus if you're in a closed room, it can't spread out as far. They mentioned that you should only bring the things into the scene that you need. So I'm going to go in with the stretcher and the body bag, and that's it. I'm not going to bring a kit in. I'm only going to bring in the gloves that I need. So essentially, don't bring anything in there that you would then take out to carry virus out. You often need to talk to the family or the people around there, but you don't need to necessarily do that in person. Much like you don't need to have that meeting in person, you don't need to talk to the family in person. So you can do that over the phone. You can do that from 10 feet away from them.
That's a fun visual image.
Shouting across the street.
Did they have a cough? What?
Did you take their temperature? Their what? Their temperature. They also mentioned in this webinar that everybody that dies at home or in the hospital is treated as a COVID-19 death. So take the precautions until they're swab proven negative. Deaths in the hospital, medical examiners don't need to see. As we've talked about in other episodes, if it's a natural death and the treating provider can sign a death certificate comfortably, they don't need to come to us. So this is one of the most important things. A lot of people that are dying of severe COVID symptoms are dying in the hospital. They do not need to come to the medical examiner because it's a natural disease course that has led to their death, and the doctor can sign them out. And then importantly from this, people who die asymptomatically haven't died from the disease, but they can still pass it on. So that's where it's really important for us. So they may be asymptomatic. They may have had a heart attack and they died, but they also could have COVID. And they didn't die from COVID. They died with COVID, which we'll come back to later. But in this case, you need to know if they have it so you can perform an autopsy in an appropriate room to look at their heart and see that they've died of an MI.
Yes.
Sally Aiken had a very interesting 3-question panel. She said that you always want to ask everybody who is sick, who has been treated, and what symptoms are present. If all of these are negative, then you can treat them as natural and not necessarily swab. But if any of these are positive, then you would ideally be able to swab. And the reason this is important is because swabs aren't always available to swab everybody, which would be an ideal world. So if you need to triage who is sick, if anybody's sick, swab. Who has been tested? If anybody's been tested positive, swabbed. What symptoms are present? If anybody has symptoms, family members, the decedent, anything, swab them. Those are the definites. And everything else you can do based on how you want to take care of them. And finally, as medical examiners, there's a lot of people that we have to take into account. So it's not just the death investigators and the medical examiners, but we have autopsy techs who help prepare and prosect the bodies. You have staff in the office, which hopefully most of them can work from home. And then you have people that run the toxicology labs, and the toxicology is still really important to be run, but they have to come to work to do this. So it's a very large coordination effort, more than just the autopsy itself.
And all of the protocols that offices have right now kind of vary based on institutions. They vary based on how many cases they're seeing, what their resources are like, etc. And so everybody kind of has their own method for dealing with the current crisis. So to go into a little bit about the performance of the autopsy, given the current climate, whenever we do an autopsy in the medical legal community, we use what are known as standard precautions. So for everybody, we're using a gown, we're using gloves, we're using...
No, sorry, you said everybody, which is true, but it's like everybody, everybody. Yeah. I tried to not smile. I'm sorry.
Okay. It didn't work. You smiled. So
I can't control this. We know that.
So as Jordan mentioned, if somebody dies at home, we can try to talk to the family and see if they had symptoms, but we can never know for sure whether or not they might have had COVID. So we treat all bodies as if they might have COVID, and it's kind of the same way we treat all bodies anyway, because there's always a risk of getting some sort of infectious disease from a body.
If you go back to one of the more recent viral crises was the HIV mm-hmm. virus, and at first they didn't really know how it was spread. We know that HIV is a blood-borne illness, and to take care of that, we use cut-proof gloves. We know that influenza can generally be protected with a mask, and you'll at least be wearing a mask. About the only thing that we regularly encounter that would need an N95 would be tuberculosis. But as most people who have been in any autopsy or a handful of autopsies, everybody's been in that one that they cut into a lung and gets a necrotizing granuloma, which is almost pathognomonic for tuberculosis. And if you're not already wearing a mask, when you cut into that, you're going to expose yourself. So kind of at the baseline, not all, but most medical examiners wear an N95 anyway. You wear a face shield for when you cut into that colon and it sprays and you get covered in something.
Oh, lovely.
Nobody wants that on their face. So we take all of these precautions at baseline anyway that should essentially protect us against COVID-19.
Yeah. The only thing that might be different in this pandemic is that offices are more standardly using the N95 versus the regular surgical mask.
Yes. And some offices have the PPARs, essentially you wear a suit with a little like helmet type thing, for lack of a better word. It covers your face and it's kind of seals your entire body. And then you have this circulating air unit that you kind of wear on your back or on your belt, depending on how the unit's set up. And it'll continuously circulate air and filter out to the level of an N95 mask. So some people are using those a little bit more. They're very nice because they cool you as you go, rather than when you just layer on a lot of layers of plastic gowns. You get very warm.
Very quickly, yes. Have definitely almost passed out.
Yep. Especially when the sun comes through that skylight at one point of the day.
Oh, yes. In terms of special precautions, with the recommendations are to avoid aerosol-generating procedures. So Jordan mentioned things like performing certain maneuvers on the body can cause aerosols to be generated. But also things like use of an oscillating bone saw, I saw. So that,
which we use to cut open the skull.
And some offices use them to cut the rib cage. True. Yeah. So the official recommendations are to consider using hand shears as an alternative cutting tool.
The other thing that I thought was interesting so we'll talk about the name. Listserv name is the National Association of Medical Examiners. And they have a listserv that has understandably in the past few months had a lot of communication about this. And they'll just kind of throw out some recommendations on what they're doing in their office and what they're seeing in their practice. And one of the things they mention is just throwing a wet mask over a face when you're pushing on a chest, because you will catch most particles if you cover the face in a wet towel, because surgical masks are expensive and you can't really clean them well and that kind of thing. But like, you can take a towel and throw it in the wash.
Yeah.
So it's an easy, reusable way to take care of this. And similarly with bone saws, I guess you can put it in a plastic bag over like the head and keep the bone saw in the plastic bag and do it that way.
Yeah. One of the recommendations, I think this was the CDC, was that you can attach a vacuum shroud to contain the aerosols if you're using the oscillating saw.
Which a lot of people do that anyway, but I guess even beyond that, there is more spray in the plastic bag can help. Somebody mentioned that on the listserv.
Oh, interesting. So besides avoiding those types of procedures, limiting the number of personnel working in the autopsy suite at any given time, using a special cabinet for handing smaller specimens that might have virus in them. Like if you're cutting the lung, you might want to put it in this special cabinet if your office has one, which not a lot of offices have. Mm-hmm. As we've mentioned, medical examiner and coroner systems are often severely underfunded. So... Yes. And then another recommendation was to keep a logbook, including names, dates, and activities of all workers, so that if there is somebody who gets flagged positive, you can look back and do case tracking and identify who else might have been at risk that day.
Other stuff that I saw was if you can, again, if you have the resources, if you have an isolation suite or a negative pressure room, and you know that somebody is COVID positive, you can bring them into the negative pressure room. Like the SF medical examiner has one of those rooms. So you can, in theory, perform your autopsies in there. I've only been in that room once, and that was when we had the body that was dissolved in chemicals because it smelled really bad, and we wanted to keep it away from everybody else. So it wasn't an infectious reason, but it was kind of a noxious chemical reason, which is also a very good reason.
Yeah.
Again, resource-wise, if you can prioritize N95s for cases that you know are positive, again, ideal world, use them on everybody. The other thing I saw that's interesting was make sure you, when you're doing an autopsy, kind of get it all in one go.
Oh, yeah.
Often, if you go and you look under the microscope and you see something, you might go back to try to get something else, or you get your tox results back and you're like, oh, well, I want to go and get this other thing. Make sure that you have everything you need and submit everything you need the first time so you don't have to go back into it. We talked about the bone saw. Do you need to open the head? If you know that they died from pneumonia or a respiratory disease due to COVID, do I need to look in the brain? Not all the time. Sometimes you do, but not all the time.
Yeah. Well, and actually OSHA right now is recommending that if any patient has tested positive, then you should not be performing an autopsy on them.
Yes. And that was my last point was, it's great. The number of external autopsies that are happening is going up. So when we say external only, we mean you're looking at the outside of the body. You might collect toxicology. So you might collect fluids, blood or urine or vitreous, the eye fluid, and run that. But you're not cutting into the chest cavity. You're not pushing on the body to expel more aerosols. It's something that a lot of medical examiners are reflexively opposed to because it's kind of my favorite sayings from Dr. Shapiro in Vermont is the only autopsy I regret is the autopsy I didn't do. Mm-hmm. And one of the people on this panel was a doc in the Navy, and they kind of drilled it into his head, always do the autopsy.
So in terms of testing for COVID at autopsy, the CDC has a bunch of different recommendations, and they differ based on whether it's a suspected case of COVID and you are planning on performing an autopsy for some reason, or if they are a confirmed case of COVID, which at this point we probably shouldn't be doing autopsies on, but if you are doing an autopsy on, they have recommendations for what specimens to collect.
And this is sometimes you need to do an autopsy on a COVID patient because they might have died from something other than COVID. So it might have been a homicide, but they have COVID, so you still need to do that autopsy because you need to get that bullet or something. So,
and while you're in there, these are the specimens you should get.
Exactly.
So if you're performing an autopsy and you suspect it's a COVID patient, you are recommended to get several different swab specimens. So getting a nasopharyngeal swab, so sticking a Q-tip in the decedent's nose as far back and kind of swirling around in both nostrils, all that jazz. Getting a lower respiratory tract swab. So this is taking a Q-tip and swabbing the lungs, essentially. So the airways and the lungs. And then also getting tissue from the lung, the trachea, which is the tube that connects your mouth to your lungs, as well as the branches of the airways within your lungs. And then if you're not going to be performing a full autopsy on somebody that you suspect has COVID, the nasopharyngeal swab is sufficient. And then if it's a confirmed case, then they really like you to get autopsy tissues, because this is also one of the ways that we study how the disease affects humans and actually causes death. So getting those trachea specimens, those lung specimens, etc., is very important. And then doing swabs just to rule out other contributory infectious diseases.
There's also a certain argument that you could have with, should I be swabbing even asymptomatic people to see kind of what the prevalence is in the population at baseline? Because right now we really do not know. Both of us may have COVID right now and we just don't know it because we haven't been tested. And realistically, given the shortage that we have, we shouldn't be tested. But in an ideal world, we would have enough tests to know everybody's status.
And actually, the NAME, the National Association of Medical Examiners, has this Dropbox of protocols that different offices can upload. And I happen to be looking at the one for King County because that's where we're going to be going for our fellowship soon. And theirs, they made in conjunction with UW. And so they are actually swabbing all of the decedents that come through both the hospital and the medical examiner's office to try and get an idea of that prevalence. So I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it is really cool. One of the things, so I'm on a rotation right now. This week I'm signing out with an attending who's actually in charge of all the point of care testing for the University of California, San Francisco. And point of care testing is testing where you do it real time. So it's not something you collect and send to the lab and they do it in the lab and they bring it back to you. It's a test that you collect it, you do a little tabletop test, and you can have a result immediately.
Like a glucometer for diabetic patients.
Exactly. And they are developing some point of care tests for COVID-19. And I've been talking with her a lot this week about how swab availability is obviously a really big issue. And it's a question of, you could say you implement a new assay that you can do 250 point of care tests in a day. But that test is good, but not great. Or let's say you can develop a method that you can do 10,000 swabs that get sent to the lab and come back within 1 to 2 days. But that is a way better test. Mm-hmm. It's way more accurate. You get better results. You get less false negatives, less false positives. You can prioritize developing that test that takes a little bit longer and not prioritize that point of care test. And I feel like that's kind of where we are with a lot of this stuff. Like this test that UW is developing is a send it to the lab and they can run, you know, 100 tests at a time, 1,000 tests at a time. And it's a more accurate test than kind of quote unquote wasting your time on, I know the big one that Trump is pushing right now is a point of care test, but it's not as good as that send the swab in test. So it's kind of a weird balance in testing right now.
Yeah.
And what is important. The other thing that's interesting is that you can save these swabs. So you can like swab somebody and put it in the refrigerator and probably even longer if it's frozen and then send it in later.
Yeah. There was some storage recommendations on the CDC website. So you can store it at 2 to 8 degrees Celsius for up to 72 hours after collection. But if there is going to be a longer delay in testing or shipping, you should store it at negative 70 yes. degrees Celsius.
Which is the common thing that we use to store bacteria or cell lines if you're going to freeze them so you can thaw them out later and grow them up again. -80s.
Do you grow a lot of bacteria in your freezer?
I grew a lot of cells back in the day.
Back in the Broad.
I have literally billions of cells.
Aw, Mama Jordan.
All my HeLa cells. HeLa293T and Heck.
Those are great names.
They are great names.
I hope I have twins. I'm going to name them HeLa and Heck.
Do it.
Kids are going to love me.
One interesting point I wanted to bring up about the swabs was, again, I'm sorry that 99% of this is from the name listserv. One of the medical examiners brought up an interesting case where they had somebody who, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, suicide and homicide rates that have changed recently, but they had a decedent who had killed themselves, and they killed themselves by shooting themselves in the head. Now, the way that you take a swab, as Nicole described earlier, was through the nose. But when you shoot yourself in the head, there might not be a nose to swab anymore. Mm. So there are some very interesting dilemmas in the medico-legal death investigation world that you would never think that you have to face until you hear a story like this and you're just like, oh, that's something that this person had to, you know, maybe you can get a tracheal swab, which I'm sure is very equivalent, but you go in with a swab and you're just like, oh.
So that's fun.
Yeah. Oh, and the other part of that is a lot of these bodies, when you go to work every day, you're like, oh, I haven't seen Nicole in a couple days. I should call her. Oh, she's not answering her phone. We should send somebody. They'll find, like, let's say, sadly, she had died.
Couldn't just use a random name? Thank you.
It's a day or two later, and we find Nicole. But now with social distancing, maybe I'm not, like, now I know I'm not going to see her every day. Nicole is not my BFF. She is a random human that I only know through work right now in this fake made-up scenario.
I love you. We text every day. We do. You would know if I were dead.
I mean, yes, true. But in this made-up scenario where we do not text daily. And now it's been a week. Right. And now that we're all staying at home, now maybe the neighbors smell something. And so then they call the cops. And now you end up with a decomposed body. One, is the virus still going to be around? And two, again, how do you swab for a decomposed body? Is the test as accurate? There's a lot of data that we just don't know that might not be answered anytime soon. But it's all these interesting things that can be posed, and we could maybe find more data out about this by the end. The other interesting test that's going on right now is a point of care antibody test. So Dr. Caruso, the chief medical examiner in Denver, was talking about there is a county in Colorado that is using this in the field. So they're actually testing decedents in the field for antibody. And antibody is what your body makes once you've been exposed to something. And by something, I mean it could be food you eat, it could be an allergen, it could be a disease. Anything that your body is exposed to, it can produce an antigen, anything your body's exposed to, you can produce an antibody to. So we look at a particular antibody called IgM, and if that's present, you could say they have been infected. But the issue is that it takes a couple days for your body to build up this antibody. So if it's not there, maybe you haven't been sick for long enough, or maybe you're past the point where an IgM is there, because that's kind of the first one that your body makes. And then later you make something called IgG. So maybe you're past the point that IgM is now gone and you're making an IgG, but this test only looks for IgM.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. I think this one just does IgM.
Oh.
So
interesting.
It's much more complicated than everybody thinks about when they're just like, oh yeah, no, point of care test the antibodies and we can move on. And it's a more complicated picture. Denver Crime Lab is also testing all first responders and police for this antibody, so maybe it does have IgG then. But they were talking about IgM early.
Well, so maybe I guess it is for getting on a scene and testing a decedent, IgM, I would think would be more would important be the better because one. Yeah. That would tell you that they're more likely to be infectious.
Yes. So maybe they have both tests available.
And the IgG they're using for the investigators.
Yeah. But I mean, I would still want to test them for IgM.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is first responders and police. So this isn't even investigators.
Oh.
This is like the Denver Crime Lab is doing this for first responders and police in Denver, which is great.
Are death investigators not considered first responders?
There is actually a, not name, but one of the death investigation communities is putting a proposition out there to consider medical legal death investigators as first responders so they can get a hazard pay. Because right now they're often not classified as first responders.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would have assumed that they were already classified as first
not
responders.
Not everywhere. So there is a thing out on that to try to get them to be classified as such.
Oh, I will sign that petition.
Yes. Petition, that's what I was saying. And Dr. Caruso was saying that he's going to start using it in Denver. There's apparently a local vendor that's supplying it, and they do a finger stick on scene. Going back to the fact that I'm signing out with this person that does point of care testing, I talked to her about this today, actually, and I mentioned that they do a finger stick, and she's like, oh, interesting, because for us, the protocol that they have on live people is you need a venipuncture. So you need venous blood. But when you have a decedent, they mention that they do a finger stick. So this test was developed to be used on a specific kind of blood. And if you're using it on a different blood, you could argue, is it as accurate? Very importantly, the same laws and regulations and things that we have on live people don't necessarily apply to dead people. So while it's really important to stick to a test and do it properly in order to prove its accuracy or to be confident in its accuracy, there are some things that we let slip a little bit in the death medical legal death investigation world because it's just not possible. But that's a very interesting test that is being implemented now.
Hmm. And it's the same test?
And it's the same, yes, it's the same point of care test.
Okay.
So what do we see at autopsy itself? Once we've done the test, we know if they have COVID, we go in. What could you expect to see on, I'm going to say this, a symptomatic person with COVID? And a lot of these findings are from people that are pretty sick. So people that are kind of sick, you might not really see all of these yet, but you can see some of them, and on very sick people you might see all of them. So the first one is you can get a lot of edema, and edema means extra fluid in the tissue. So there's a certain amount of water that all your cells should have, and if you have too much, the cells can kind of expand and you can get water in the space between the cells and things kind of get blown up and they kind of get squishier.
Yes.
I guess is the
that is
the colloquial way to say it.
No, that's definitely the medical way to say it. Squishier.
So things that you're not too surprised about, your lungs can get very edematous, but also your brain, you can get cerebral edema. You can get kidney or renal edema. And essentially you're just getting this very big inflammatory response and you get a lot of fluid in all these areas. You can see pleural effusions, which are fluid on the outside of the lungs, so kind of filling up the space around your lungs, which can obviously cause more pressure and make it harder for your lungs to expand.
Not good for getting in oxygen.
Not good at all. In the lung itself, you see something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, which I'm not going to go into the details on this because we should really do an entire episode on ARDS, but it's essentially this inflammatory reaction and where your lungs just have way more of certain kinds of white blood cells there and they're very edematous and all of the bad things. And the other interesting finding that they're seeing are these widespread thromboses. And so a thrombosis is a little blood clot or a big blood clot. And they're seeing just a lot of blood clots kind of everywhere. They're seeing it in the heart. They're seeing it in the lungs. They're seeing them into veins. So the femoral vein, the inferior vena cava, which is the big vein that brings blood back to your heart from your body. Also in other small veins, like the splenic vein, the one that goes to your spleen. One of the few veins that's named very nicely. Interestingly, SARS, they also saw increased thromboemboli. That was the 2003 coronavirus. So there is some evidence that... Oh, don't chew on the cord that connects the microphone to my computer, please. So when you get these small thromboemboli, these tiny blood clots that are going everywhere, they can cause the tissue in the area to not get enough oxygen, and so they cause local tissue death. And if you get a lot of little emboli all around your lungs, this organ that's already struggling because of this inflammation, now you're all the things, and now you're getting some blood clots everywhere. It's just kind of a perfect storm of bad things. They're not very sure right now what the mechanism is for all of this. They're getting a lot better at it. So they've seen that a lot of this virus can cause this quote-unquote prothrombotic state. So it dysregulates a few different factors in the inflammatory pathway that leads to increased thrombi. And this has been seen in other diseases as well. Dengue has this. And like I said, SARS showed it. So it's not too surprising that there are these tiny little clots, but, you know, it doesn't help the situation.
The only thing I wanted to mention is that when you look at tissue under the microscope from the lung, you can also see evidence of infection by the virus. So
yes, good call.
Yeah, in lots of different types of viruses, we can see changes in the way that the cells look under the microscope. And in COVID-19, you can see these characteristic viral changes. So you see these very large, atypical looking cells with things inside of them. And so that can kind of be an additional clue that you're dealing with a virus.
They're called viral inclusions. And
yeah,
and
some of them are tested on a bunch of different ones.
And like they're very, it's interesting that they're really distinctive. Like herpes looks very different than CMV, looks very different than coronavirus.
Yeah.
So you can tell even from the way that the cell looks what kind of virus is infecting it, which I think is really cool. But yeah, that might be because
you're a pathologist.
And a little bit of a nerd. Oh, yeah, that's okay. Fine. I'm okay with this. So we know that a lot more people are dying right now, in theory, because of COVID-19. The question is, how are other numbers changing because of this? We know that there are less people out and about. There's less people driving. There's less people out in the streets. So again, a lot of this right now is colloquial because we don't have good data on it yet because we haven't gotten through the majority of the pandemic to do that data on. But colloquially, what we're seeing on like the list and whatnot, MVAs are going down because fewer people are out driving in cars, so we're having less car accidents. But at the same time, some people are saying that they're seeing more suicides and homicides because of social distancing, which another word for social distancing is social isolation. And a lot of times in different diseases, isolation causes a lot more harm than good. Or you're now having people that have intimate partner violence that used to be able to escape by going to work, but now they can't go to work, so they're being trapped, quote-unquote, at home with their partner, who might lead to more deaths in that sense.
Yeah.
So right now, we don't necessarily know good ideas of these numbers. Maybe we can revisit this at a later date and kind of go over the overall data, but colloquially, some types of death are going down and other types of death are going up. It's also really important for us to say what death is caused by COVID and who is dying with COVID. There was a very interesting point in the listserv that I saw that was saying how this one office, they'd done maybe 20 COVID deaths. But none of them were people that weren't, again, this is what they said, weren't going to die in the next couple of years anyway. So they weren't people that already didn't have a really bad heart condition or didn't already have end-stage diabetes and other really bad comorbidities that they were kind of teeing up to pass away anyway, and COVID kind of pushed them over the edge. So there's a small part of me that's wondering, like, if in 2 or 3 years we're going to have a decrease in some autopsy because a lot of these people were exposed to this and died a little earlier.
Oh, Interesting theory.
And then in a couple years, all these people that would have died in a couple years already passed away from COVID.
Huh.
Because, like, you know, we're probably going to have, what, 80,000 deaths across the country from COVID total-ish. Like, I'm curious how many of those are people that would have been spread out over the next couple of years anyway. Not all, for sure. There are young people that are dying and whatnot, but a lot of these people are older with other comorbidities that probably would have died in the next couple of years.
I thought your point with that was how to determine the cause of death in those cases.
That is awesome.
That is an yeah. interesting thought that yeah. the number of autopsies might go down.
Yeah. That is also, it's hard because, like, I feel like from any of these points, you can branch off in five different ways with interesting thoughts about them, because that I also didn't want to talk about. But it's interesting because, you know, many of these deaths seem to be from people with comorbidities. So, you know, it's speeding up the deaths, but it's not necessarily causing an excess of deaths.
Right.
It's just changing when the distribution.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah, huh. Hadn't thought about it that way, yeah. but yeah.
This entire thing is just a social experiment.
Just kidding. Alien just kidding. Overlords. Just kidding.
Yes, exactly. But there is an issue with this all happening acutely. Obviously, we know that a lot of the ICUs are getting overstrained. We might not have enough ventilators to cover all these people. In order to be an accredited office, you need to have a maximum number of autopsies per forensic pathologist. These numbers have already skyrocketed with the opioid epidemic. And now that we're having this influx of COVID-19 related deaths, you are increasing the number of autopsies each forensic pathologist is going to have to do. And if they get above a certain number, a lot of these offices might not be accredited anymore.
Well, the name has actually, yeah, they have temporarily suspended the caseload limit part of their accreditation process.
But that's scary though, right? Because that caseload limit is pretty high. It's still a lot of autopsies.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's one of the big concerns within the community is how is this pandemic affecting the shortage that we have, which we've talked about before. There are only 500 practicing forensic pathologists and the country needs about
crazy
1,200. So, yeah, the opioid epidemic has already stressed out this and now we have this pandemic. So, yeah, there's a huge concern that we're not going to have enough people to be dealing with how many cases are coming in.
For sure. So one quote that I found interesting, who Ed Donahue, who is a medical examiner in Georgia, said, "No matter how these deaths are currently being attributed, after this pandemic terminates, an excellent approximation of the true fatality rate of COVID-19 deaths can be made by the calculation of excess mortality for this period." And he said that this was very helpful during the 1995 Chicago heat wave. "Almost certainly because of the scarcity of testing and other reasons, we will find that the number of COVID-19 deaths has been grossly underestimated."
Hmm.
Which I find interesting.
Yeah.
Because as I said earlier, you know, how many people's deaths are being kind of sped up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of speculation right now.
Speaking of which, in terms of death certification, so actually listing COVID-19 as the cause of death, the National Vital Statistics System recently came out with an issue that kind of went over how to integrate COVID-19 in the death certificate. And they say that it should definitely be specified as being related to COVID-19, and that's in order to keep better track of the actual number of cases, and that usually it'll be the primary or underlying cause of death with, like, intermediate conditions such as pneumonia or acute respiratory distress syndrome being factors. And when a person has comorbidities, they should be listed as conditions that contribute but are not the underlying cause of death.
Yes.
Yes.
So kind of the end point of all of this, I think, would be once we've done our autopsies, a lot of these bodies can keep virus around for a while. And in order for kind of the public health overview, which is what medical examiners are really important for, is body disposal.
And actually, in terms of COVID-19, there, you just do standard waste disposal and transportation for the body. So no special precautions need to be taken at this point in time.
For some reason, I had heard about them trying to, well, I think the big reason you hear about this is because so many people are dying in places like New York City that they're kind of running out of space to hold these bodies. And we didn't really talk about this, but one of the important roles of a medical examiner is to kind of disaster response and morgue coordination. So if a lot of people are dying in a small area, a medical examiner could help coordinate getting a bunch of refrigerated trucks,
yep,
large buildings or ice hockey rinks, a lot of people talk about, where you can keep these bodies stored for longer, where they're not going to then decompose, and coordinate what needs an autopsy, what doesn't, what we're going to dispose, what we're not. People can't really have funerals where you can view things right now.
Right.
So how are you going to coordinate all that? So I know in New York, they changed the laws so the cremations and crematories can keep going 24/7 versus before the law was there. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's like, say, only these 8 to 12 hours a day are you allowed to run crematoriums.
Oh, interesting.
And so they've extended that. So in terms of disposal, I know that I think it is slightly recommended that they get cremated. I think I had heard. Is that not true?
Maybe that's not true.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
But I know that they are running them more frequently because obviously when you cremate a body, it's less space.
Yeah, that's a perception that a lot of the public has, is that these bodies should be cremated.
Okay.
But it's not necessary. And cremation rates have been going up anyway.
Yes.
Over the,
yes,
the last couple of years.
Yes.
But no, you can still dispose or, you know, take care of,
yes,
the body in whatever way you would normally. But yes, funeral planning, because of the shelter in place orders, that's been delayed.
Yes.
And yeah, we talked about a lot of this in our mass fatality episode,
yes,
although we focused a lot on mass disasters, but this pandemic actually, you know, fits the definition,
yes,
of needing to activate your mass fatality plan in certain areas.
Definitely.
So
they also talked about transporting bodies, how a lot of the times you think of funeral homes or the medical examiner / coroners doing this, but they've been talking about maybe getting fire or paramedic to help transport bodies, to even maybe having family self-transport bodies,
yeah,
and really telling people the precautions they need to take before they do this. So there's this larger role of medical examiners that people often don't think about, but body storage and disposal is very important. And hopefully deaths will start to downtrend in the next week or so, but
yeah, I was watching one of the weekly COVID town halls that UCSF has,
yeah,
and they were showing the various graphics of the current trajectory for cases, and it definitely looks like we've been stable for the past several days, so fingers crossed.
And I kind of wanted to end with this interesting quote that was posted to the listserv. It also had this cute little picture that I'll probably post on the Insta. The plural of anecdote is not data. So I feel like a lot of us are hearing a lot of stories and a lot of things. And if you compile them all in your brain, you can start to think that you're seeing a trend. But it's not real. And we really need some good, well-controlled studies. So if you keep hearing about, oh, this person took this medication and they felt a lot better, you're hearing about the ones that feel better and you're not hearing about the ones that didn't feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I feel like, especially in this world right now, people really need to kind of understand that a lot of what's happening, what a lot of people are hearing, isn't real life necessarily. And we need to keep that in mind.
Take everything you hear with a grain of salt.
Yes. And with our nice salt load, Sochmeads.
Sochmeads. Okay. So if you liked this and any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It's how we get boosted up on the various podcasting platforms and other people hear about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
On Insta, we're at the Dead Tell Tales.
Our Facebook page is Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, you can send us an email with comments, questions, concerns, wanting more pictures of the cat through the website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com.
And our opening theme music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
So thank you, everybody. Wash your hands.
Yeah, and I hope you're staying safe, healthy, and sane while on lockdown.
Bye, guys.
Bye.